So just in case you don't get lost on our little roadmap we're on this morning, my thoughts for the next 15 minutes are going to lead us into communion. Then we'll share that together. And then Ron Maders has some family news that he's going to share with you after our communion time. And then the kids will come back in after that. Psalm 23 is a very familiar Psalm of David, possibly the most well-known of the 150 different Psalms in our Bibles. And it contains the most frequently read words at the most difficult moments. We turn to Psalm 23 when we've run out of hope, and when we seem to be unable to get out of bed, when fear is about to overtake us. We turn to Psalm 23 when we're standing by the graveside of someone we weren't ready to let go of just yet, or when we need to hear the promise of our Creator so we can endure one more heartache, one more misfortune, one more storm, one more loss. And I wonder if Psalm 23 ever came to Peter's mind during the last days of Jesus' life and his resurrection. There's a line in this psalm which Jesus puts flesh on during his ministry. It's in verse 5. And David writes this line. He says, "You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies." Let's say that together. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. I want you to hang on to that line because we're going to come back to it in just a few minutes. Now let's jump ahead a lot of years, and for a moment, let's take a walk through the shadows of the courtyard of the high priest house. Jesus has been brought there by a crowd after they found him in the garden. Well, they didn't really find him there, did they? They were... That angry crowd of people was led there by whom? By Judas, that's right, who identified Jesus with a kiss. There were no shortage of enemies at the table this night. Now back to the shadows of Caiaphas' house, there's one silhouette which looks familiar in the darkness in the corner, and it kind of looks like Peter, but this isn't a place where you would expect to find him right now. Peter hasn't given off much of a shadowy vibe in what we know about him so far, you know, in his story. He's more of a passionate guy. He's the guy wildly swinging his sword at the head of one of those who comes to snag Jesus when this angry mob emerges. He's the one who always seems to answer first and then think later, even when he doesn't know what he's talking about. He's the one who jumped off the boat, all excited about the possibility of walking on water. He's the one who walked away from his fishing business when he first met Jesus. He's not usually the one hiding in the shadows, but here he is in the shadows, sobbing deeply, on his knees, hands covering his face. Matthew and Luke tell us Peter went outside and wept bitterly. Mark describes it this way: he broke down and wept. John decides to spare sharing his friend's deepest remorse in his worst moment. Wouldn't you hate to have your life defined by your worst moment? All John has to say after Peter denied being with Jesus three times, he writes, "At that moment, the rooster began to crow." Now, earlier this same night, Peter, in all his glory, said to Jesus, "Lord, I'm ready to go to prison and to death with you." But Jesus knew better. "I tell you, Peter, today before the rooster crows, you'll deny me three times." And then Peter boldly says to Jesus, "Even if I have to die with you, I will never disown you." Which is exactly what Peter chose to do. He said one thing, and he did just the opposite. On three different occasions, when asked if he identified as one of Jesus' followers, Peter responded, "I don't know the man." And he made this claim to two different servant girls and one other smaller group of observers. In fact, Matthew writes this last time Peter began to call down curses on himself, and he swore to them, "I don't know the man." And I'm guessing his last adamant response was jarring for him to hear himself saying, to swear that he didn't know Jesus, to call down a curse on himself if he was lying, to say, "If I've ever been with this man, you can kill me right here. I swear on my life, I do not know him." And I'm guessing as he said those words, he was already wondering who he had so quickly become. Just a few hours earlier, he vowed to stick with Jesus, even if it cost him his life, and now he's willing to bet his life that he never knew him. the next place we find him is in the shadows, drowning in sorrow, drowning in remorse and confusion, drowning in shame. And Peter is inconsolable as he tucks himself away in the darkness of the shadows outside the courthouse, the courtyard of the house of Caiaphas. So after Jesus' death and resurrection, one of the next places we find Peter is in a boat with a few other disciples on the Sea of Galilee. He decided to go fishing, and a few of the others chose to go with him. And now the message Jesus left with these guys was to go to a mountain that he told them about. Jesus had left them distinct instructions about that. He asked them to go and wait for him there. And the mountain was in Galilee. The lake was also in Galilee. A mountain and a lake are not the same thing. Why is Peter fishing on the lake instead of waiting on the mountain? Jesus has risen from the dead, and Peter saw him from, he saw the empty tomb, and Peter saw Jesus with others behind locked doors on one occasion. It's implied in Scripture that Peter even met with Jesus privately. But in spite of all that, Peter decides to fish on the lake instead of wait on the mountain. And it seems like an odd time to decide to go fishing. One writer says this about Peter. You see, Peter couldn't deny his denial. The empty tomb did not erase the crowing rooster. Christ had returned, but Peter must have wondered, after what I did, will he return for someone like me? I'm guessing Peter may not be the only person with these thoughts. He's not the only one to do the one thing he proclaimed so boldly he'd never do. Anyone with a broken marriage faces this question. People with addictions face this question. Those with dark secrets face this question. If you have ugly thoughts about others, you face this question. Those of us who are judgmental or entitled or self-centered, we face this question. I face this question. I bet you do too. Is Peter the only person to do the one thing he said he'd never do? And I've wondered how many roosters Peter killed the first few months after his day of hiding in the shadows. Our shame is heartbreaking, and our shame is hope-shattering. I have a friend who asked me recently, how do you overcome the shame? How do you overcome the label people put on you, the disdain they feel towards you, the finger-pointing, the whispers, the distance? Any one of us can lose so much that's precious to us so quickly with one bad choice, one bad moment of lacking good judgment. And the shame is overwhelming, flooding any thoughts of redemption, any thoughts of grace. Our question is, will Jesus return for me? Do you remember what Jesus did next? While Peter should have been waiting on a mountain instead of fishing in a lake, Jesus was at a lake instead of a mountain because that's where Peter was. And Jesus invited Peter to breakfast, and he prepared a meal. Now let's wrap back around to Psalm 23 and the line I said we'd come back to. David, writing about God, says, let's say it with me again, "You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies." What David the shepherd did for his sheep, Jesus the shepherd did for Peter. Jesus invited Peter to his table. He saved a seat specifically for him. And Peter accepted the invitation. So he sat there with the enemy of shame and the enemy of remorse and the enemy of regret and lost hope and little faith and heartbrokenness. And they ate together in the presence of his enemies. Now here's a wild thought. What if Jesus does for you what he did for Peter? This isn't the first time Jesus had prepared a table for these guys. In Matthew 26, we read about another time. On the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the disciples came to Jesus and asked, "Where do you want us to make preparations for us and you to eat the Passover?" And he replied, go into the city to a certain man and tell him, "The teacher says, my appointed time is near. I'm going to celebrate the Passover with my disciples at your house." So the disciples did as Jesus had directed them and prepared the Passover. Jesus did hear what David describes. The shepherd prepared the table. He made all the arrangements. The disciples basically just showed up and put together a few pieces. In verse 27 of Matthew 26, is what happens in that time. Then he took the cup, and he gave thanks, and he offered it to them, and he said, drink from it, all of you. Drink from it, all of you. This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. I don't want you to miss this. He says, drink from it. And then the next three words are what? That's right. Every one of you. Each one of us. If there's any doubt you have a place at the table, listen to Jesus' words. Drink from it. All of you. All of you includes those of us who did what we said we'd never do. It includes those who find it so difficult to even venture into a church building because of other places you've been. It includes those who are addicted, ashamed, embarrassed. It includes those who've blown it, those who've self-destructed. It includes those of us who've caved under pressure, compromised what's most important, rationalized to do what we wanted to, and denied our identity in Christ. And Jesus says to you, and he says to me, drink this. Accept my forgiveness. Lean into my promise, and let me take away the shame. So as we share in this time of communion together, think about this. Communion is for community. We are a community of believers. Some of us may be thriving right now. Some of us may be coasting right now. Some of us may be barely surviving, even in this moment. But I guarantee you one truth which bonds us as a community is this. At some point in time, we've all asked the question, will Jesus return for me? Now, that question may come to you a little differently. You may ask it, will Jesus accept me? Will he love me? Will he forgive me after what I promised, after what I fought, after what I did in my weakest moment yet, or after even what I blatantly, rebelliously chose to do? Will he return for me? And here's his offer. He says, eat with me and drink with me, all of you. We will enjoy fellowship in the face of all the enemies which haunt us. I just want you to take a moment and look at the person on your right and look at the person on your left and know that you're surrounded by other believers who also come to this table with their unique enemies. No one is better than you. No one is worse than you. We're all in the same boat when we should have been on the mountain waiting. But here we are in community, celebrating the one person who could bring us all together. We're the body of Christ, a community who comes together in weakness, but is made alive and made righteous through the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. We're going to sing together as the bread is passed. I want you to hang on to this piece of bread, and then we'll take that all together after I pray. Hang on to that as they're continuing to pass that. Well, if you already drank yours, that's good too. I can't imagine anyone who's had to deal with shame any more than Peter. Everyone knew. They all knew about his worst moment. We've been reading and talking about his worst moment for nearly 2,000 years now. I mean, aren't you thankful the Bible's still not being written today? I mean, aren't you relieved your worst moment wasn't written down in the most read book in the history of the world? I don't understand how this happened for Peter, but somehow the invitation to the table Jesus prepared on the shore of the Sea of Galilee, somehow something happened there that took away the shame. And you can read about that for yourself. It's in John 21. All I know is that it is a monumental journey to go from hiding in the shadows of Caiaphas' house to standing before thousands on the day of Pentecost preaching the gospel. And I know whatever Jesus did for Peter, he can do and has done for us. Jesus dies and lives again. And we die and live in and through him. And amazing things happen when we trust Jesus with our lives. Let me read this one line again from Matthew 26. He took the cup and he gave thanks and he offered it to them, saying, drink from it all. Drink from it, all of you. This is the blood of my covenant, which is poured out for the many for the forgiveness of sins. Forgiveness changes everything. It changes everything. Let's pray.
Can I set this down? Good morning. My slides did not format very well, so I'm going to get it up on my laptop here. All right. Not my laptop, my iPad. All right, good morning. I'm Ron Mader, in case you don't know. I'm one of the shepherds here. I'm also the shepherd that's over facilities. And one of the discussions that we have been having with the leadership team is our space here in the sanctuary. So we wanted to bring everybody up to date with that space and what we're thinking about this space and some long-range planning. I wanted to begin by talking about when Jackie and I, when we visit other cities and go to church in another community, one of the things I like to do is make sure I show up early for church, because I do not like to walk into a group of strangers and have to struggle to find a place to sit. So I always get there early, and there's usually plenty of spaces. And whenever I walk into a row and someone's already sitting in the row, I usually don't walk all the way up to the person and sit down shoulder to shoulder, hip to hip with that person that I've never seen before. I'm going to put at least one chair, maybe sometimes two chairs, in between us just for their comfort level, as in mine too. So anyway, that's kind of a standard practice, and that's just common courtesy, I think. Well, what happens is when you do that over and over and over again, you create a lot of space in the area that is not used and not very usable. So one of the things, I've been on the long-range planning for this church for a long time, all the way back when I was a deacon. I was actually on a committee with Bill Rhodes, Phil Cullum, and myself, those three engineers. Can you imagine what that discussion had to look like for those of you that know us three? But that was back in the 1990s after the land deal and those types of things. Then the early part of this century, Gary Reynolds, Jim Odak, and myself were on long-range planning for quite a long time. So I've been doing that. I was also did the same thing at Lexington Christian Academy when we developed that complex over there. And, of course, I've been involved with the construction of our classroom area. But one of the rules that I've heard, and it's like the gospel truth because it seems like it's true, is that's called the 80% rule. Well, let me get my clicker out. And it's going to be hard for you to read. The formatting made this kind of small. The 80% rule says when an average annual worship attendance reaches 80% of the comfortable seating capacity of the worship room, crowding becomes a serious growth limiting factor. So even though in this room we have around, it for comfortable seating, around 470 to 500. That's the number of seats that's comfortable. For Easter, we had 520 people in here, and that was not really comfortable. But that's our comfortable, that's the capacity of this room. 80% means that when we have an attendance of 375 to 400, that's 80% of our capacity. And so it begins to get uncomfortable at that point in time. So is that really true? Are we crowded and are we limiting our growth? One of the things that I thought I would do is I try to show, first before doing that, here's our attendance over the last 13 years. And sorry if you can't see it, but there's a kind of a burnt orange line that goes across this graph. And this is the attendance every Sunday from 2006 to 2019. And the orange line is 400. And so you see, at least for the last 6 years, we've been hovering high 300s, 400. And we go over and we go down, but that's exactly what this 80% rule says. That's what's going to happen. You'll get a few more, few down, but we're averaging in the high 300s or 400s. We are averaging 80% of our capacity. Now, what does that look like? Now, some of the formatting didn't come through very well, so I do apologize. But on my screen at home, there was 328 seats, and this is actually a slide from some planning that we've done for this room. There's two more rows in that slide than what we have here. So there's 328, it's about 40 more seats than what you're sitting in here. But let's assume if that's 328, what would it look like for 80%? Well, that's 80% right there. And so if Jackie and I walked in that door, for us to find two seats together is going to be a challenge. We'd have to come all the way up front in that setting to find a seat. So it is uncomfortable. Yes, we have 64 empty seats. That's a lot of chairs empty, but it just doesn't work that way. It becomes crowded. So what we've been doing among the leadership staff is we've been talking about what are some options for fixing this. Of course, one of the options is tear the building down and rebuild. So we let's put that off the table right now. We are not planning to do that right now. We're not starting the campaign. So just in case y'all think we're doing that, I thought I'd ease that. We're not starting anything like that unless somebody has a couple of $1 million and then we'll start that quickly. But what we've been doing is what are some other options that we can do to alleviate this crowding that might be not too impactful on our church congregation. And the staff actually did a lot of collecting of these ideas, and they presented it to us, and we've been thinking about it. And so what I might do is we've actually picked an option that we really like, but I want to talk a little bit about some of the other options that we have talked about. And so I'm going to put three up there. Three options that we talked about, and we've actually done two of these options already, and that's we've had kids on worship meet the entire assembly time and not be here with us. Well, that would free up a lot of spaces. But there are some negatives with that. Some parents might like to see that happening. Get them out of here. But there are some parents that like to have them with them and want them to learn what it means to be in a worship together with adults. That is a good learning practice. The bigger thing is the Kids on Worship team, what it takes to make that happen Sunday after Sunday after Sunday is a lot of work. And so I was involved in these types of things when we did this before. It's a lot of effort. So that really wasn't one of our top picks. Two services in the sanctuary, sandwiching the Bible class. We've done this before. And one of the things that happens with this is the second service becomes a lot bigger than the first service. We have a lot of trouble getting people to man the first service. There's a lot of different things that have happened that it wasn't ideal. Let's just say we didn't love that situation, but that is an option. Another option is we could meet in the Gathering Place classroom with a live feed and meet concurrently. So they would have a video camera and have a video camera in the Gathering Place, and we just have people show up there and they would sit and listen on a screen. And not whether they participate or not, not sure. Well, that didn't rise to the top is one of the options that we thought would be good for us to start with here. What we did decide is we thought that the Gathering Place did offer an opportunity for us to have a separate worship experience going on at the same time as this with a smaller group of people. And so what we are going to introduce today is the idea of adding a Gathering Place classroom worship time. It would be concurrent with our current worship, so it would be happening at the same time that we are having our worship. It would have its own worship experience. There would be another preacher or speaker in the room that would be sharing. There would be singing in the room. If Barrett's here talking about Zechariah or Habakkuk or whatever at the end of the Old Testament, that he's talking about. Kevin might be there talking about communion. So there would be two different atmospheres going on. It would be a lot more intimate, a lot more connecting. It would be different than here where you're all sitting there and I'm doing all the talking and there's not really any interaction. There could be more interaction. It would allow us to develop more leaders in our church, which is a good thing. More opportunity to speak in front of people, which for many people, that's a very difficult thing for them to do. But it would more so, it would ensure that people are connecting. And we don't pick an option that just kind of sticks people in a back room in front of a TV screen so that they can be a part of this worship, which they really wouldn't be. We're going to call it, though, to kind of tell you our vision for it, we're going to call it life group worship because we primarily are going to develop this for our life groups. We have approximately 16 life groups here at Southside. These are smaller groups of about 25 to 30. I mean, some of them I know are a little bigger than that, and some of them are a little smaller. So 25 to 30. And so if we picked two different life groups to meet back there, that would be around 50 or 60 people in that room. And then those two groups would have that separate worship at the same time we're having a different worship. And we would rotate. So let's say life group one and two meets this Sunday and they're back there. Next week, life group three and four would meet. They'd be back there next group. So that would occur for eight different Sundays. We would have the exact same worship presentation, the same sermon for eight Sundays in the gathering place room. So everybody would have the same experience. And what it would do is it would pull out of this room about 50 to 60 people and allow there to be more space in this room for this worship. We would repeat this, like I said, for eight Sundays, and I'm not sure why I had that. I think I put that last one there because I actually went through this explanation with three different people, and two of them I didn't connect at all. So I'm assuming that you're going to have questions after this, so if I'm redundant, it's only because I know for some reason it doesn't connect as well. So here is what, and this is the plans of our site here. On the left is the smaller rectangle that's blue, supposed to be blue, yeah, it's blue here, is the gathering place room where the life groups would meet for worship. And then the larger one is this room here. And so that's the two, especially for some of you that maybe have not been in the gathering place room, that would tell you where it would be occurring. This plan that we have, we plan to begin this fall. It would be for the fall semester. You would expect two rounds of these times of worship. So what do I mean by round? If they prepare a worship with a sermon, they will do that eight times. And now we have all the life groups have been through that one. Then they would prepare a new sermon with a new worship and do that eight more times. So you'd have two rounds. So what you could expect if you're in a life group, you would miss worshiping in the sanctuary twice this coming fall, which that's not, a big impact to everybody or even a big sacrifice, I think. So we will do that. We will repeat that in the spring. So in the spring, we'll do the same thing. We would not plan to do it in the summer. And when it comes to if you have questions about what is this actually going to look like, we don't really know yet. If you ask Kevin and Barrett, well, hey, could you tell me? They're going to say, I don't know. I mean, they're not totally, they have ideas, but it hasn't been put together yet. And it's going to take a lot of work. So we don't exactly know what it's going to look like, but that's coming. So let's get back to 64 empty seats. You know, you might worry, well, what is that going to look like? Is that going to, it's going to look like that. So you see, if you come in, there are pockets of three seats, and I even put one of four seats in there. Yet still, there's quite a few people in this area, and I'm just showing these two rows there. There's quite a few people in this part of the church that are still worshiping. Yet, it's a little bit more inviting for visitors. and people that are new that, you know, if you've been coming here for 30 years, you don't worry about this because you come in, you know where you're going, you're very comfortable, you don't mind sitting hip to hip with anybody else in the room because you know everybody. But visitors and people that are new, they're not quite there yet. And so it's good to have a little extra space for them to feel comfortable, because that's really the point. We really want to be inviting to people who are new, who maybe are looking, who need help, and would love to find a community to worship with and to live with and to have family with. And so that's what this is about. We want this to be the best place it can be. So, is there anything, I'm going to look just to make sure, is there anything I left out on that? All right. So, and I had two items. The second item is we did want everybody to know we've had plans for replacing this structure for years, but we've not wanted to talk about them because we felt that everybody did such a sacrificial, you were so sacrificial in giving to the classroom structure behind us. We have no debt there, that we didn't want to pressure the church, especially when we know individuals that really hurt, to help us make that happen. And so we have not wanted to start something like that and stress you out with that. So, but at the same time, we want you to know we do have plans. If we ever felt it was the right time and we had the monies available, we felt it, you know, it was potentially possible, we have plans for this. And we'd like to go through, you won't be able to see it very well. If you have questions about it, you're welcome to talk to me afterwards. This is a 3D view of our site. Nicholasville Road is the road, the big road on the bottom right. Dantzler Court is the road on the left there, and that's looking at our church. And the pink looking structure is our new classroom area. Here's the floor plan of that area. I showed it to you a second ago with showing you where our worships is. And this is the area that we're looking at. If we were going to tear something down and rebuild, we would actually tear down this structure and we would tear down the classroom building, catch room and the offices. Yeah, classroom building, yeah. Strike that one if you don't mind. We would tear down the offices. The Board of Architects, they really liked that front structure that was built, and I don't think they had let us tear that down. So the plan would be we would tear this down, and we would rebuild something like this. I was wanting to try to zoom in, but I didn't get a chance to do that, and I'm going to turn around so I can see it. We would end up moving this pulpit area over and back up to Dantzler Court. It would be depressed down. We'd have more of a stadium effect so that it'd be easier for people to see. It would seat around 625 people just in this lower level. We also are going to put a balcony. The balcony would be up here, and it would seat altogether about 750 people. 756 is what that says. That would be the plan. One of the nice things about it is right now when people come in, they walk right in front and everybody looks who's come in, right? So if it's over there, the entryways are generally over there for the, you know, people coming in either that door or usually that door, and that's the back of the church. And so you would be walking there, at that location. It would actually move a little further toward Dantzler Court than where that wall is. The other thing is we would be replacing the cat's room would be over there in the middle. There would be a classroom over here, and over there would be a nursery. So that's the plan for this. That's where we are right now with the plans for this level. This is a 3D view of the same level, and you can see this is looking more from that area over there, looking back this way, and you can see the location of the cat's room and the seating and what that would look like. The reason I show this is to show the second level. The second level shows the balcony there, and then that's above this area is where we're going to put the new offices for the staff. One of the neat things about this plan is that we will be connecting the second level of the children's worship, which I don't know if you know, but that's busy all through the week. We'll be connecting that with all the offices and the balcony. They will be all on the same level. They will be connected. I think that's a very healthy situation for the children's wing and also for the offices. There would be the new stairs, Bobby Morris helped put this together. But right there's the stairwell out in the lobby area that will go up to the new area. At least if you wanted to go up there from this room, you'd go out and go up the stairs, and then you would access it. So anyway, I haven't looked at the time. Okay, I'm okay. This is a 3D view, and you can see that upper level balcony with the offices. There's about 2, 4, 6, 8 doors that go to the offices there. And you can see it's connected to the children's wing in that area. Was I supposed to say about what this was going to cost? No. Okay. I looked at Barrett and he was like... Okay, I'm not going to say a word. That's it. Let me see. Make sure there's something else here. So, when are we going to do this? Are we going to do this? Right now, it's all, you know, on the back table. We don't have any plans for starting anything at this point in time. Who knows if it'll ever get built? You know, I guess as I end this morning, I know with the millennials, the big thing is tiny houses. You know, everybody likes to get a tiny house. You know, why do you think bigger houses? So if we get more and more millennials on the leadership team, it might end up looking more like this. So I don't know if we're going to do this or not, but that could be the possibility if y'all don't like this idea. I'm just here. Anyway, that's what it is that we wanted to communicate. If you have any questions about any of this, you're welcome to talk to me. Anybody on the leadership team would be welcome to share with you about this.